For America, number 67. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy. Whether you are new to Linux, upgrading from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in Going Linux. We hope that you'll find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done. On this Computer America episode, we are not using the regular live third Tuesday of the month recording and rebroadcasting that. We're actually rebroadcasting a recording that I made of my appearance on the previous Saturday's Blog Talk Radio version of the Computer America show. It's a little longer than the normal shows because it's actually a full 2 hours rather than the broadcast radio 2 hour show that is actually only about an hour and a half worth of content. So it's a bit longer, but I think it's a bit better. And I have to say that we did not use the Blog Talk Radio recording because of their licensing agreement. This is actually a Skype call recorder recording of that show. Here goes.
Broadcasting live, it's America's longest-running national radio talk show on computers, Computer America, hosted by national columnist Craig Crossman. Look for Craig's weekly column in your favorite newspaper. This show is being beamed nationwide at ComputerAmerica.com. Keep it here for technology news, computer products, guest interviews, and your phone calls. You're listening to Computer America.
Hello and welcome into the Computer America show. It's the nation's longest-running nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. Computer America is heard around the world and coast to coast. And I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
And I'm your co-host, Charles Tyndall.
Hey, Charles, you made it.
I did. See, told you.
Exactly. And so Charles Tyndall, my co-host, now you're out and about somewhere. You're in Alabama, correct?
I am. I'm in Enterprise, Alabama, about a half hour, I think, north of Fort Rucker, Alabama. I'm visiting an old Army buddy. And there's nothing out here.
Well, as I said, it's our Saturday edition of the Computer America show, and we're glad that you can be here with us. And we got a great show planned for you on today's program with a very interesting topic. And let's kind of get things started here because we're going to be talking all about Linux on today's show, the subject of Linux. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, the Linux operating system continues to be, you know, very important. And every month we devote an entire Computer America show to the subject of Linux. And if you have a Linux question, well, today's the day for you to give us a call. Now, joining us in to help us in this endeavor, well, is Larry Bushy. Larry is the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast. Larry, welcome into Computer America. How are you?
I am fine, and I am looking forward to this episode because we've got Charles Tyndall as the co-host and as an ethical hacker. I'm sure that he's into Linux.
Yeah, I am. See, this has been a really good week for me. The London Minute is about me. Guests want to talk to me. I love it.
Yeah, as long as it's about him, he's really like,
that's fine. This can be all
it's
about
Charles Tyndall America show.
And Charles is actually a certified ethical hacker. So
okay, all right.
He's not a white hat and he's not a black hat. He's a gray hat.
Now, okay.
Which means he has to go into the dark side from time to time in order to do good things. So.
Yeah, so you do penetration testing and you do surprise penetration testing.
Actually, well, penetration testing is the politically correct term for hacking and having fun with it.
Right.
Honestly, I I'm going to offend people, somebody who's listening that is a penetration tester. I don't like the term penetration testing. Mostly because, you know, the child in me giggles every time, you know, penetration testing. You know, but you know, more so because all penetration testing is—it's very structured. It's very good for the enterprise world, but it's not what hackers do.
Right. They don't follow a script.
Right. It's not like, oh, you have a web application. I'm going to try these 10 SQL injections. No, not happening.
Yeah, no.
You know, I just went on board with a very large client. They are actually the largest credit card processing company in the world, and they have actually asked me to do basically what's called a red team test, where I'm on their payroll, but I know nothing about their infrastructure, and everything that I'm about to learn is all because I'm going to hack them.
Mm-hmm. That sounds interesting.
And it's so much fun.
and the reason that for those in our audience who aren't familiar with hacking, white hat, red hat, black hat, whatever, green hat, and don't understand this, and how that relates to Linux. Charles, how does it relate to Linux? I know the answer, but our audience might not.
Well, most application servers run on a variation of Linux, and two, the majority of the tools that you're going to be using to be doing what I do run on a Linux variant. The most popular one currently being Kali or Pentoo, which is my baby. But you know, most of us don't run Windows because you know that's what we're attacking.
Yeah. Well, Windows doesn't have all the tools that Linux has, and secondly, you could end up being in more trouble using Linux than you would. I mean, using Windows than you would using Linux.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, here's what we're going to do. What we're going to do is we're going to. I always ask Larry to pick a topic. And to talk about during the show, and then as I said, while we're speaking, if you call in or interact with someone, we'll interrupt what we're doing and talk to you. Now, we also have a way for you to follow along as we're doing this. If you go to our homepage at computeramerica.com, and under the archives pull-down menu, you'll see show notes. So you click that and click there are show notes. It'll open up a page, and you'll see. Our blog, it says today's date, 10/5/13 show notes, and it says both hours on Blog Talk Radio this Saturday, and we have a link to Larry's the website, the Going Linux podcast is right there, but also we have two other links below that paragraph. It says, when it says hour one topic, you can click on that, it'll open up a Google Docs document, and you can see everything that we're talking about on today's show. All the talking points, everything is there, links, it's there. And then in hour two, we're going to do email. It says hour two email. You open up that, and you'll see a Google Docs document with a Computer America email for the show. So you can not only listen, but you can follow along. And that works whether we're live or, you know, you're listening to us in delayed broadcast. We have that there as well. And then so that's the how you can kind of follow along. And today's topic for the show is 25 reasons to convert to Linux. So 25 reasons. I think just one reason would have been enough, but we got 25 of them here.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the topic of the show, and you can kind of follow, as I said, you can follow along with us, and we certainly, but we welcome your questions and comments and suggestions at any time during the program. So,
good comments only.
Yes. That goes without saying. So we're going to start off with the October 5th, the show notes, and it's right there, the Linux topic of the month, 25 reasons to convert to Linux. And this is not necessarily a religious experience. It's not a religious conversion. It's all about
depends on who you talk to.
Exactly. Let's talk about this. So let's start off with the topic and the talking points. And Larry, why don't you kind of take it away?
Okay. So for our new listeners and for Charles, who is essentially a new listener to the Linux topic on Computer America, we have talked in the past about on the Going Linux podcast, we have folks write into us with ideas and questions, and we answer the questions from email and voicemail and other things that we get. And one of our listeners named Nancy had challenged our listening community to come up with a reason, a good valid reason to switch to Linux. Now, she uses Linux. But one of her challenges, quite frankly, is the fact that she has a particular application that she uses that is available only for Windows, and she hasn't found a suitable replacement in Linux. So
that raised the
wait. Back that up. She hasn't found a suitable replacement
for the application that she's using, which is
QuickBooks.
Quicken, yeah, Quicken or QuickBooks, one or the other. I forget which it is.
And little did she know the amount of controversy and ire that she would raise with it.
Oh yes, yes.
It's been ongoing. So much so that they've coined the phrase Nancy Gate for this.
Yes.
And this has been going on for quite some time, and evidently it won't die. So
no, it just keeps coming back. So I thought, well, okay, I'm going to have to come up with 25 reasons of my own. So I did a little research, and I actually found a link to the Linux info project that started back in 2004, and I'm not sure that it's been updated recently, but it was part of the Bellevue, I think it's Bellevue, Washington, Linux Users Group that put these 25 reasons together. And I've got them in our show notes, kind of reworded a little bit in my own words. And if you're interested in seeing the original 25 reasons, which have some additional reasons, bonus reasons, if you will, for businesses, there's a link at the bottom of our show notes that takes you right to that page. So you can look at either one and follow along. But we wanted to provide some reasons for Nancy. And some of our listeners have provided some reasons, but only about one or two. But these are some very good reasons and well-researched reasons from folks who who've done the research, quite frankly. And for us Linux users who have used it for a while, these are all old hat reasons. They're all things that we know about, and sometimes we forget about them. So, and these are reasons not just for the average home computer user, but some of these might be of interest to businesses as well. And as we know, at an ever-increasing pace, organizations across the globe, whether they're governments or schools or businesses, are converting their computers from the Windows operating system to Linux for some of the reasons that we're going to cite here. And they're also moving their applications that they use, like Quicken or word processors or spreadsheets or whatever, from the commercial software that's available for Windows and Mac to open source software that's available for Linux. And much of it is also available for Windows and Mac. So we can talk about that if we can get into a sideline on some of these, or a side conversation about some of these 25 points that we have here.
Okay. All right. So, and again, all these are available at our show notes at computeramerica.com so you can see it. Okay.
Right. Exactly. So the first reason is that Linux is free. And again, just to review, we've talked a lot since introducing the topic. The topic is 25 reasons to convert to Linux from whatever it is you're using. And I'm going to focus on Windows because Windows is the operating system on the majority of computers out there today. So let's focus on converting from Windows. The big reason is it's free. So unlike Windows, Linux is licensed in a way that allows the Linux developers to provide that software to you at no charge. And you have to realize that even if you get a copy of Windows included for, quote, free with your new computer, you're still paying for it. And especially if you buy a CD or a download from Microsoft or in particular a CD from a big box store somewhere like Best Buy we were talking about, you're paying, in that case, hundreds of dollars more just for the operating system for your computer.
Wow. Yeah. It really does tack on cost, which you don't normally see, obviously, because it's included into the purchase price, but you're paying for it.
Yeah. But see, it's still entertaining, though, actually. I mean, some companies have started to actually sell Linux on the shelf installed on their machines, but
yep,
the machines aren't any cheaper. And I don't understand that. I'm like, what?
Well, and we've talked on the show about some of the companies that provide Linux pre-installed or specialize in Linux computers like System76 and Xareason and other companies like that. And in that case, they're providing in many cases, better made hardware. But even in the cases where they're providing it on generic hardware that's provided by a company in China somewhere typically. They are doing the research up front to make sure that the hardware that they select, the wireless card they select, the display that they select, all of the components are guaranteed to be Linux compatible, because their objective is to sell Linux on this computer, which you don't get when you buy some generic hardware off the shelf from Dell or HP or somebody else with Windows pre-installed on it. It is optimized for Windows and guaranteed to work if you replace Windows with Windows. But on Linux dedicated hardware, it's guaranteed to work with Linux. And so, yeah, you're paying the same amount for the computer, but what you're paying for is, in some cases, higher quality hardware, and in some cases, the additional research and the additional work that goes into ensuring that it is the best quality hardware for running Linux. So there's value in there, is the main point.
Okay.
All right.
You're still getting the value. You're still getting a value that you might not be able to see in the, on the price tag, but evidently Larry's saying that it's still there.
Yeah, on those computers. And of course, that's not to stop you from installing Linux on your existing computer. So if you have your own computer, maybe it's running Windows, maybe it's running OS X, you can install Linux on there to replace that operating system, or run it alongside that operating system in a dual boot fashion, or you can put it in a virtual machine, which is a fancy way of saying running one operating system inside of another.
And again, this claim to OS X, he's talking about the Mac, of course, you can do a dual boot, but you can also do, as you said, you can run something called Parallels desktop, which allows you to run different operating systems concurrently. With dual boot, basically you're in one or you're in the other. The advantage of having a dual boot system like Parallels on the Mac is that you can run both simultaneously. Not only can you run them simultaneously, you can run them side by side. Parallels gives the option of literally dragging and dropping from one operating system to another, documents, files. You can move them. In some cases, there's even a mode in there. I think it's called concurrency. So you don't even know what operating system you're in. It's completely transparent. It looks like you're running on the Mac, but you can be in Linux. It doesn't matter the way it just seamlessly merges both operating systems, and you don't even know it. You just go about doing what it is that you want to do, and you click on the Linux document that's in there. It'll be running Linux, but you'll be on the Mac desktop. So it's really slick, very inexpensive. I think Parallel sells for retails for $79.99 or something like that, and it'll allow you to run both operating systems. To me, I think that's the best of both worlds. Running them concurrently, you have so many different advantages. You can copy, paste, move from one to the other seamlessly and effortlessly.
Right. And so Parallels is dedicated for the Mac, I think. I don't think there's a Parallels version for any other operating system.
No, it's Mac. It's Mac only.
Well, there's VMware, but it's not Parallels.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So it's there are other virtual machines. So there's VirtualBox from Oracle. There's VMware from VMware. I think it's VMware is the company. VMware Fusion is what you want to use on the Mac if you want to run your dual boot image inside of OS X, and you're using something like VMware. Of course, Parallels gives you that capability, but VMware and VirtualBox, the two virtual machine software that I just mentioned, those two are cross-platform. So there are versions for the Mac, for Windows, and for Linux. So you can run one version of Linux inside of the other. You can use Windows inside of Linux. You can use Linux inside of Windows. About the only thing that you can't do technically legally is to run Mac inside of something else, because
I love how he added legally.
Legally, yes, yeah, technically, in the approved fashion from the company that uses the fruit as its logo. So you can do Hackintosh sort of software inside of a virtual machine on Linux or Windows. So that's the technical way to get around that. But anyway, back to our points, I think. We're on point number two now. And we're talking about converting from another operating system to Linux and reasons for doing that. And reason number two would be another feature of the Linux license allows you to do things like view how it's built, view the source code. If you're a programmer, you understand what that is. And the Linux license allows you not only to look at the programming behind the Linux operating system, but if you want to modify it so that it does something a little bit differently, if you're a programmer, you can actually go into Linux and change the way it works. And you're completely free to do that.
Wow.
Under the license of Linux. And they talk about this from the perspective that Linux is free, as in freedom of speech, as well as free, as in free of cost. So the freedom of speech is you're free to use it in whatever way you choose. You're not locked down by its EULA, the end user license agreement, to use it only on one computer or two computers or three computers. You can use it on as many computers as you want. You can modify the software any way you want.
Try doing that with Windows.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you can use it for whatever purpose you want as well. So you can use it for good or you can use it for evil. either way, and in addition to that, you can give it away to other people. You can sell it, if you wish, to other people. You don't have to let them know they can download it for free.
So if I make a modification to it and I really like it and I want to sell it because it has that kind of unique modification, I can do that.
Absolutely.
Right? Yep.
Absolutely, under the license of the Linux operating system itself.
So Charles could write a special version of Linux that's designed for hackers, for example, and has all kinds of hacking tools and everything, and he could put a package together, and he could actually sell that, and it would be perfectly legal for him to do that, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Cool.
If Offensive Security hadn't already done it, I would be all over that.
Yeah, and we've talked on the show about versions of Linux that are designed specifically to test being hacked. Yeah. So there's a damn vulnerable limit Linux, I think is what they call it.
I love that one.
Yeah, yeah, which is designed with flaws in it so that you can use it as a test bed for testing to see if your security software works would be one application for that. So two good reasons to convert to Linux are a result of the way it's licensed. It's licensed so that it can be given away for free, and it's licensed so that you can do with it what you want. It's kind of the ultimate software that is designed with the user in mind. It's not designed with making the developer a whole bunch of profit.
Now, you say in version 2, you says you can redistribute your modified program, but then you have a parenthesis and says, under certain conditions. And then give it to yourself. What are the certain conditions?
Well, depending on how you've done the modifications and what other software you've used, you've got to look at the licenses under which the other software is licensed. So, for example, the Linux operating system itself is licensed under a license called the GPL2, the GNU Public License version 2. And that gives you all of the freedoms that we just talked about. There is a version 3 of the GPL, which is more restrictive in that if you're using software in whatever you're developing that is licensed under GPL2, you can license your software using GPL2, GPL3, or other licenses, certain other licenses. The thing that you're required to do, though, is that if you do distribute your software, then you need to ensure that you contribute whatever your modifications are back to Linux or back to – you can do this with other GPL software as well. So whatever the software is, you need to contribute your modifications back to the developer of that original software. That's the term of the license agreement. That's the condition. Now, if you're using something that is GPL3, and Linux itself is not GPL3, but many of the applications that run on Linux are GPL3, what GPL3 adds as an additional condition is that you must license your software under the GPL3. So it gives you the ability to use whatever the program is, the GPL3 license program, and you can modify it in any way you want, but some of the conditions that are included in doing that are you must give your modifications back to the developer so that they can incorporate it into their software if they wish. They don't have to. But then, in addition, GPL3 requires that your software, you don't have the choice of what license to license it under. You have to license it under GPL3. So that's an additional condition there. So you would think, okay, well, those are some pretty severe conditions, but it's all designed to protect the freedom of the user so that the software that you develop as the secondary developer remains open source and free.
Okay, that is nice.
All right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Any other discussion on that before we go on to point number three?
Yes.
The freedom behind it. I mean, there's also some other things that you can get in there too. I mean, like look at different distros like and a distro is a distribution or a Linux variant. Like Windows has XP, ME, and so on and so forth. These are all like, you know, your Debians, your Red Hats, and things like that in the Linux world for anybody who didn't know. But it's, you know, the beautiful thing is you can build how you want it built, and I'm sure we're about to get to that one. So,
Yeah, that's very important. You can, if you don't like the way it's built, you can modify it and build it the way you want it to work, and that's very important. And if you have the skills to do that, have at it. And the difference between the Linux variants, and you described, you know, Windows XP and Windows ME and Windows 7 and so on. The difference between Linux distributions and the versions of Windows, or even the version of OS X, is that those versions of those other operating systems are either the current version or an old version, some of them obsolete and unsupported. In Linux, different distributions are all current at the same time, and within a distribution you can have older versions and some unsupported, but you can have Debian, you can have Red Hat, you can have Linux Mint, you can have Ubuntu, all of which have a current version that is live, actively developed, and supported by the developers of that particular distribution. Okay, that's kind of a bonus point.
Okay.
All right. So point number three.
I think it's also like the downside too, you know, at least in my opinion, because like I'm on Ubuntu 13.04.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 13.10 is scheduled to be released any day now, and you know their long term support is still 12.04, I think it was. Mm-hmm. You know, the biggest thing that I've seen with a lot of different users is they have a problem picking the distro that's right. You know, they're like, well, is this one more current, or is this one this way, or this one have better features, and so on and so forth. And it really doesn't work that way. It really is pick the one that flows best for you, and it'll grow as time progresses. You know, it's not like, you know, like in the Windows world, you have to have, you know, Ultimate to get this, you know?
Yeah, right, exactly.
We're going to be back. We're just at the bottom of the hour break. This is the Computer America Show with Charles Tendell and Larry Bushy. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Lots more coming up.
This is your London Minute, and I'm Patricia Reichel. That's better. A factory reset on my laptop. 172 Microsoft updates later, a check disk scan, and my Windows 7 computer is no longer squiffy. Not responding errors have vanished.
Squiffy.
It's fresh and fast. But I have been reminded of a few annoying programs I removed once before in 2010. My bloatware has now been zapped. Thank you very much. I'm going for clutter-free computing, where all files are tidy in logically named folders. I decided to not reinstall AVG's free antivirus. I installed Avast's free software instead. Security expert Charles Tendell gives it a thumbs up. That's good enough for me. 5 hours later, and my computer has moved from grave condition to a stable one. I think I deserve a woohoo. To sponsor the London Minute, send me a tweet. I'm at ComputerTweety. This is Patricia Reichel for Computer America.
I always love those. And this week, this week's was awesome because I am an international superstar. Great. It's 33 minutes after the hour. First hour is a Saturday edition of Computer America. We are doing our 25 reasons to convert to Linux. You should just do it because it's awesome, and you don't have to spend 5 hours configuring it to get it to work.
And by the way,
it just works.
Larry, you can hear Charles's head swelling every time he hears that London Minute.
It was great because when I heard it the first time, I was like, did she really? And I've been trying to get Patricia to come on the show and just have just pop in and have a couple of things so we can talk about things like the London Minute and the word squippy.
Whatever that means.
Yes, exactly. And by the way, we're going to have a new London Minute. We introduce a new one each week. So in the second hour, at the bottom of the hour, we'll have a brand new one, a London Minute. And this one has something to do with Nokia. So we'll hear about that. But please continue on, Charles.
Well, that was it. I was, you know, my head was swelling even more.
We're talking about the 25 reasons to convert to Linux, and we're going to start the point number three, which is high quality support. And you wouldn't think, something is free, you don't get support, right?
Here's the thing, and he's we're going to touch on this one. Yep. But in my opinion, the reason their support is so high quality is because it's real time. It's people who are really experiencing these issues or a problem. You know, I had a wireless card issue with a laptop that I bought for an employee, and it was the wireless card wasn't waking up. You know, I learned many, many years ago that it's likely that if you're having a problem, at least 100 other people have had it. You know, when it comes to a product like Microsoft, you either have to wait or just accept that that's how it's going to be. But you can always jump online and go to a knowledge base or just type in your general issue and, you know, get your Google on, and you will find, you know, a viable, usually relatively simple solution to your problem.
Yeah, and not only is it the people who are experiencing the problems that are coming up with the solutions, but it could also be the developer of the software that is coming up with the solution. Oftentimes you'll find in the forums that it's the developer or somebody from that organization that's providing the solutions. And of course, as they get those problems reported in the forums and the chat rooms and various other places, they're taking a look at them and determining, is this something that we need to fix in our software, or is this something that's unique to this particular hardware? And if it's something that they need to fix, they'll fix it. And so they've got a lot of vested interest in being in those news groups and forums and places like that. So you can expect a lot of high quality support, as Charles said, because it's real time, because it's there. It's people experiencing that problem right now along with you that are struggling and eventually find that solution. And you can find these kinds of support channels through news groups or forums for your particular Linux distribution. And don't think that you have to look only at the forums for your distribution. Linux is Linux. The difference between the distributions, there's more to it than this, but for the most part, the difference between the distributions is what tools get packaged with Linux, with that particular distribution of Linux, what applications get prepackaged and put on the distribution CD for you. And that's pretty much it. The bottom line is it's still using the same Linux kernel, and there may be one desktop environment or graphical user interface or another that's different from distribution to distribution. But in general, if it's a Linux problem, it'll be a Linux problem across all of the distributions. If it's a problem with a desktop environment, it's a problem with that desktop environment, regardless of what distribution of Linux is using it, and they can all, for the most part, use any particular desktop environment or any particular application. If it's a Linux application, it's going to be across all distributions as well. So you can go to news groups, forums. You can subscribe to podcasts like the Going Linux podcast, got to get the free plug-in, or other free support. As always, it's available but for the most part on the Internet. And if you have a problem getting on the Internet, well, then you're out of luck. Yeah, you got other issues.
All right, so what you're saying is that Linux is Linux, but you might be surrounded by, you know, a different graphical user interface, being on the distribution, different applications supporting it, all those things. But I guess the bottom line, you say the Linux kernel is the Linux kernel, so you cannot make changes then to the Linux kernel? Is that something that you
can actually do? You can.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely, yes.
You can. See, the Linux kernel is basically like think of a salad. Think of your ideal salad bowl, right? Everybody's salad comes with the green leafy stuff, whether it be lettuce or whatever it is. The Linux kernel is the green leafy stuff. It is the core, you know, unless you have – I had this really tasty seafood salad the other day that had no green leafy stuff in it. Very good stuff. You know, I guess that one would be like Kali or Backtrack. But anyway.
Or BSD or something.
Linus Torvalds does not have to approve any changes made to the Linux kernel then.
He doesn't. I mean, the Linux kernel is Linux kernel. I mean, it gets updated every you know, gets updated just on the same regular, well, pseudo-regular schedule as everything in Linux. But the beautiful thing about the Linux kernel is, again, I'm just going to give you the base of which to build your car or your salad, you know, and you can put whatever you want on it. Ubuntu went one way, Debian went another way, Pentoo went one way. You know, all these different Linux distros took it and went the direction that they wanted to go with it, what they felt was best for their creativity, and you as an individual can do it.
So let me ask you, is there anything about Linux that cannot be changed? Is there anything that is held set, you know, untouchable, or you can change anything in it, to the kernel, to whatever?
Larry?
Yeah, you can pretty much change anything. the only, you know, it's like that green leafy stuff in the salad. If you don't like that the leaves are too big, you can chop it up smaller. You know, I guess about the only thing you can't do is make it bigger, because you know, because it comes one size. So
the metaphor won't handle.
Yeah, the metaphor breaks down there. But yeah, the license under which you agree to use Linux allows you to make whatever modifications you want. Mm-hmm. And as long as you provide those modifications back to Linus Torvalds and the folks that work with and for him, then you can do whatever you want and distribute it. Now, if you are not going to distribute it, you can make those changes and just keep them to yourself. You don't even have to give them back to the Linux folks. Mm-hmm. So if it's just for your own personal use, no problem. You can do whatever you want with it. You can rewrite the entire kernel if you have the skills to do that and the desire to. So, yeah, you can do whatever you want with Linux.
Yeah. Okay, so let's continue on with the next point, which is...
This point is actually, again, related to... the difference between proprietary software, and what we're talking about there is typically commercial software that you buy off the shelf or on a pack in a package, or you pay some money for, and then when you get that product, you're required to comply with whatever the end user license agreement says, and typically that is you can only use this software for whatever we designed it to do, and don't try to make any changes, and if you do, you're breaking the law. That's basically it. And with proprietary software, you're always at the mercy of the publisher of that software. So, for example, have you ever had your favorite software application be discontinued? Maybe through planned obsolescence
Absolutely.
Or something like that? Yeah. Or the developer makes a drastic change that you don't like removing the start button, the start menu. Yeah, that kind of stuff.
My most recent recollection of that is I used to have something called Bias Peak, which was a wonderful editing software from Berkeley Systems, and they went out of business. And so one day when they went out of business, they didn't remove the feature that, you know, that looked for authentication. So I switched machines, and when I did that, it asked me to re-authenticate it. I went to the authentication link page, and sorry, we're no longer here. Couldn't re-authenticate it. So basically, that program was rendered useless. Fortunately, I was able to find another program which works. But you know, you hear things like that all the time.
Yeah, except in the open source world.
The only downside in the open source world, in my opinion, for the whole, you know, the software changes don't happen, is when you go online and you're looking for how to do something in an application, all of the responses, like if you have something that happens, or you want to install a piece of software, you're looking for, say, an audio config software, the last response on it is from 2 years ago, and you're like, is that still applicable?
You know, yeah, most of the time it is. Most of the time
yeah,
it is.
That's,
but
that's yeah. the thing, you know. With the way the open source software is licensed and Linux as well, is the fact that even if the programmer that's developing it, let's say there's one programmer developing your favorite application, and he retires or she dies, okay, and there's nobody left to take it on. It's open source. The source code is available. Someone else can pick up that project and probably has already and can provide support for the application or even continue to develop the software and oftentimes for free and continue to develop that software. So somebody going out of business is much less likely to happen in the open source world and with Linux as well. Not only are there many, many, many versions of whatever it is you're looking for in the open source software world, but even if your favorite stops being developed, somebody else is likely to pick that up and do something with it, even if that something is just continuing support for something the development stopped on 2, 3, 4 years ago. And the
or
way
you can
I look
do it.
Or you can do it yourself. Sure, absolutely. And sometimes the way to look at it is if your favorite software does what you want it to do and it's not actively being developed, maybe they stopped developing it because it's perfect. They finished. It's done. There's nothing left to do. So that's one way to look at it. But if you wanted to make a change, you can do it.
You know, it just occurs to me that at this rate, we're at 0.4. We're never going to get to all 25 reasons. So
that's
just
okay.
Stay for 2 hours.
So what we'll do is that we'll get as far as we can. But remember that these show notes are always available to you at ComputerAmerica.com. Just click on our show notes, and you can see all 25 reasons. We'll probably get maybe to 9 or 10 of them.
Yeah, and maybe as we approach the top of the hour, we can kind of scan through these and give a general idea of what's included in the rest of the 25 that we didn't talk about.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Let's move on with point number 5 now.
Point number 5, yes, this will take a while. Okay, so we talked about not being obsolete from the perspective of the software developer goes out of business. Well, as it says in the original article that I linked to, I'm just going to read what they say because I couldn't have said it any better. It says, there is little or no fear of major obsolescence, planned or otherwise, with Linux. This is because the Unix architecture on which it is based has been exhaustively tested and refined for more than 35 years and has proven to be extremely efficient, robust, and secure. Improvements continue at a rapid pace, but new versions remain basically compatible with the underlying Unix architecture.
Nice.
Yeah. So you're not going to be obsolete because it's continuing to be developed quite rapidly. And, you know, the downside is it's often tough to keep up with all those changes. But that's point number 6. You're never forced to upgrade. So if you want to use a 2-year-old version of Linux, you can use a 2-year-old version of Linux. And typically, the newer versions of Linux are highly compatible with older versions. And generally speaking, those older versions are supported with security patches, and most application upgrades will also work on older systems for quite a long time. Now, older versions of Linux do go out of date and do become unsupported. Don't get me wrong. It's just that unlike with the commercial operating systems out there, the support that's available for Linux distributions and versions of Linux that have been around a long time continues even longer than it does for those commercial versions. So you could be using a 4, 5, 6-year-old version of Debian or Red Hat on a server and continue to use it for, you know, another 4, 5, 6 years without having to upgrade. And on servers that are in business or even those servers that support the internet, it's not unheard of for them to be running for many multiple years without upgrades and without anything more than security patches applied to them, because when you're running a server, you don't want to change. You don't want to be upgrading all the time. You want everything to be stable and steady and to continue to work without messing with it. You change something, you risk breaking something.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay, so, and the next point is on upgrades as well. There aren't any upgrade fees. Software costs little for retraining as well. So if there are any changes to the Linux operating system itself or even any of its applications, typically they're changes that are more evolutionary rather than revolutionary. There are some notable exceptions, of course, but in the Linux world, it's progressive upgrades as opposed to radical changes that are typical.
Okay.
All right. Mm-hmm. Point number 8, and this one's for organizations and companies. There are no onerous requirements to keep track of licenses, and no penalties or escalating prices for not meeting the terms of the end user license agreement. What this really means is that for companies, if you're using Microsoft's products, the operating system, any of the applications, you, as part of your agreement with Microsoft, are required to keep records of the licenses, who has each license, who has which versions of the licenses they are using, and sometimes what other products are being used along with your Microsoft products. And so there's this whole requirement that you have people, and in large companies, whose job it is to keep track of the Microsoft licenses. Think about that. Paying somebody full time to keep track of the licenses that for the software that you are paying license fees to another company to use, and they have tight control over how you use them, but also the fact that you need to report back to them. They don't keep track of your licenses. You do. And part of your license agreement is for you to report back to them. So that's what we're talking about, onerous requirements.
Okay, good. That's nice.
Yeah, the fact you don't have to do it with Linux is nice, not the fact that you have to do it with a commercial operating system.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. All right. And point number 9.
Short and sweet.
3 words, far superior security. Linux is designed with security in mind. And the original versions of Windows, as the original versions of Unix, were designed before the internet existed, or the World Wide Web existed for sure. And the security issues that we're facing today are primarily due to the fact that the Windows operating system is still for the most part, using the same kind of architecture that they started with back in the days of Windows version 1, which most people didn't see, quite frankly, version 1. But they're still using the similar sorts of architectures. And as a result, the same security is applied to Windows with additional patches, additional add-on software, additional security applications, additional third-party security applications required to keep you secure. And with Linux, it's all pretty much built in. I mean, you can get antivirus software for Linux, but generally speaking, as I heard it said fairly recently, Linux users tend to prefer to patch the problems rather than put a Band-Aid on them with antivirus software. So it's Linux is far superior security. Point number 9.
I agree.
All right.
Okay. All right. Point number 10. Linux is highly resistant to system crashes, and you rarely need to reboot. And this is something that is hard to explain to somebody who's not technical. And I'm afraid I'm not even technical enough to describe why it does this. It's just that if you have ever used an operating system like Linux that's based on Unix, like OS X that's based on Unix, it's based on BSD, which is based on Unix, it is much more stable. OS X? OS 10, whatever.
What I mess with Craig because every time I say OS X, he's like, it's OS 10!
Yeah.
OS 10! like that's his OS, that's his OCD.
Pet peeve, yes. So these operating systems that are based on Unix are far more stable. And Linux is certainly based on Unix as well. And all you have to do is use it for a period of time to realize that you don't have to restart your computer every morning. You can let it run for days and weeks and months without restarting, even as you apply upgrades to the software, security patches, other things. Typically, you don't have to restart your computer unless there's a major change to the operating system itself, to the kernel itself, that requires a reboot in order to initialize something. And if you're a server administrator, oftentimes there are even ways around doing that, so you don't have to reboot your server.
It's mostly because it's compartmentalized. You see that same design in like the more modern browsers now. Like for example, Google Chrome. When a script misruns in Google Chrome, that window itself will crash because the Google Chrome full browser is basically a container that holds the different sessions or the different windows as a compartment. So you can close off or crash a compartment one at a time without impacting all of them. You know, and that's a beautiful thing, and that's actually in the Linux Unix kernel, and it's what makes it a true multi-user environment.
Yeah, well put, and simply put too. Thank you for that. I'll plagiarize. I mean, I'll use that in my explanations later. That's good. So, yeah, Linux is much more stable. Point number 11: extensive applications are available to accomplish almost any task on Linux that you can do with other operating systems. There are some limits, but whatever you can do on OS X, whatever you can do on Windows, whatever you can do on Sun Solaris, you can do on Linux for the most part, and you can find an application that will do what you want it to do. Now, it's not going to do it the same way in all cases. Certainly the Firefox browser is the same Firefox browser, and it works basically the same way on OS X or Windows or Linux. But when you're talking about financial software like the one that Nancy was having so much trouble finding a replacement for in Linux, there are plenty of alternatives out there, but they don't work the same way as Quicken does. Mm-hmm. And there are some features in Quicken that she has just not found available in the alternatives that are available on Linux. And that's one of the reasons why she hasn't switched full time. But hopefully these 25 reasons that we're going through here will give her at least some pause.
Okay.
All right.
So what number were we at?
We were at 11, and I think it's about time we go through the rest of these and kind of summarize some of these, and we may not even get through the entire summary. But point number 12 we've already talked about. Each distribution of Linux has its own unique characteristics, and so you want to find the one that is best suited to the way you want to use Linux. And if you don't find one, learn how to program and go make your own. You can choose to configure a Linux computer for a laptop or desktop or server or a file server or router or firewall or supercomputer, and typically you do that when you install it. Point number 14 is its applications conform to industry-wide standards, and we can go into a lot of my pet peeve with some of the Microsoft stuff that I use at work that doesn't conform to industry standard. HTML5, for example, on a browser, but we're not going to because we got to get through some of these others. Linux generally runs faster on the same hardware as the proprietary operating systems. That's point 15. Point 16, Linux is compatible with other operating systems, and the files that you create on Linux are typically shareable with Windows and vice versa, and even the Mac. very high ethical standards are maintained for Linux. And if you want to read more about what that means, there's a paragraph on that, point number 17 in the original article that we linked to. And it talks about the fact that some of the proprietary companies have come under antitrust allegations and been convicted of these kinds of things, and that's not heard of with Linux. No forced hardware upgrades. That's point 18. Point 19, you can use Linux on almost any processor architecture, whether it's Intel, AMD, ARM, 32-bit, 64-bit, whatever. Linux is open source. No secrets. Governments use Linux, and we'll relieve the rest for the reader.
That's right.
I've got one like one-off throw at you point. Linux is what runs your iPhone and most of your smartphones nowadays. Ha! There you go.
Take that.
There you go. You can read the rest of them, of course, at our show notes at ComputerAmerica.com. We're gonna just pause for a few seconds, and we'll be back with hour two of Computer America. Stay right with us. All right, so we are doing our All Linux show with our guest correspondent, Larry Bushy, the host of the creator of the Going Linux podcast. And in the first hour, we were talking about the 25 reasons to convert to Linux. And we got to about 21 of them. But you can read the rest of them at ComputerAmerica.com. Just go to our show notes page, and the links are there, and you can see all that for yourself.
And I don't know if you noticed, but there are actually 26. I gave a bonus reason.
Yeah, we have a bonus one for you there, 26 reasons. You can check it out at our
because website. Linux is awesome.
Yes, it is. So now that's why I have a show on Linux every single month, because it is such an awesome operating system, and people more and more people need to know about it. So we're doing everything we can to inform the public about it, that there are alternatives to Windows and to Mac and other operating systems, so Linux.
Actually, here's another interesting tidbit. Did you know that the majority of the internet runs on Linux?
Yes, servers, all that stuff, it's all pretty much Linux controlled. Yes, it is. Yeah.
So every single solitary day, mm-hmm. everyone uses Linux in one form or another.
And they don't realize it. Yeah, we did a show, Charles, a couple of months back about unusual places that you'll find Linux. We found Linux in motorcycles. We found Linux in coffee brewers.
Coffee makers.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of things,
Kinds of, that was a fun show. And that's available. Do you remember, I don't remember what episode that was, but it is available at the Going Linux podcast. We only archived the past 3 weeks with the shows here at Computer, but that one at Blog Talk Radio, we do have that one. So you can search for that Linux show. That was like about 3 months ago, I think we did that, 3 or 4 months ago.
Yeah, something like that.
Uh-huh.
It's really cool. I mean, honestly, so Larry, here's a little insight into Charles. I have this weird hobby. I collect random Windows errors. So I have this photo album that I've been meaning to, like, I have an electronic album on my Google Pictures that I've been meaning to publish and just, like, make a blog out of all of the interesting places that I've ever seen, like, a random Windows error.
And that, you see them in all kinds of places. And movies.
The scariest place I've ever seen them was on a plane. I was like, oh, no. You know, I was like, that looks like the blue screen of death, and it's in the cockpit. We have a problem.
Yeah,
you know, I need to get off this plane.
I don't know about scary, but the one that amused me the most is a Windows 7 screen that I saw a screenshot of, where as you are shutting down Windows, if there's a program running, there's a screen that comes up that says this program is preventing you from Windows shutting down. Would you like to, force quit, essentially, to put it in Linux terms? And on the screenshot, the program that was causing Windows not to shut down
was
shutdown.exe.
It's the infinite loop.
Yeah. Yes.
the reason I brought up my weird Windows one was its companion database is all of the cool places to see Linux or Linux friend running, you know. And I've seen them like McDonald's.
Yeah.
I was at a McDonald's where it had rebooted and it was waiting for the login. It was at the login prompt. And I couldn't tell you what Linux it was because it didn't have a message of the day that told me any of that. But it looked, you know, from the boot up, it looked like it may be a Red Hat. And I was like, oh, that is awesome.
Yeah,
you know, it's free. They're cutting on costs there. But it is so entertaining. I mean, my favorite Windows error of all time is the one where it says Windows has encountered an error. And that's it. It's
yeah.
Like Windows, like, really? What was
Thank
the
you.
Error?
Thank you for nothing.
Right?
Exactly.
It's like it's broken. Thank you.
Yes. Windows broke.
If you reboot it, it will work. Exactly. Exactly.
No guarantee.
Okay. And Larry, so you've seen this one, right? The show The IT Crowd.
Uh-huh.
Have you tried turning it on and off again?
Yeah.
All right. So we're now going to move or shift gears and go into email for the show. And these are selected emails that Larry collects over the month that he feels will be relevant to reading on the air and talking about on the show. And so we're going to do that for the second hour. And again, if you have any questions about Linux and you're listening to us live, that's between the hours of 3 and 5 p.m. Eastern Time on Saturday. You can call in and speak with us, 347-884-8881. That's 347-884-8881. It's on the very screen that you're listening to the show on, so you should see it there. And we will take your calls. And again, any comment or suggestion about Linux, any questions, this is a unique opportunity to speak to someone who really knows it and can probably help you answer your question or take your comment and suggestion and make use of that. Again, 347-884-8881. We're going to now shift into email for the show. And again, you can see all of this. Wow, a lot of people moving into the into the page. But this is the email for the show. Again, you can click on that link at our show notes page at computeramerica.com. And you can see all of the different emails that we're reading on today's program. So let's start off with Mike, who wants to know about VMware Player.
Right, and of course he's running it on Linux, so it's the version for there. Mike writes, I am interested in using virtual machines to assist me with balancing my personal and work tasks. I have used the VirtualBox application and understand most of the concepts concerning virtual environments. We use virtual environments at work, but we use VMware for that purpose. I have listened to your podcasts, episode 188 and 190, in an effort to assist with downloading and installing, but seem to be missing the point of where to obtain the software to create a VMware environment. I can't seem to find this in the repositories. Am I looking in the wrong place? Should I go to VMware's website to get the download? I tried that, and all I got was a text-based file download, which didn't seem to be what I was looking for. Usually, I'm able to find all the components needed to add software to my system, but this time it eludes me. I want to set up a Dell Precision M6500 with this environment. It has 128 gigabyte mini SSD with a 750 gigabyte hybrid drive and 500 gigabyte 72,000 RPM drive. I was planning to load the operating system on the SSD with the normal folders on the hybrid drive and databases that I work with on the 500 gigabyte standard drive. Through all of this, I hope this was not too ambitious. Help! By the way, I've been listening for a long time and really enjoy the podcast. I believe that I always learn something new with each episode or pick up a really good tip or trick. Thanks. Mike. So, lots of questions, Mike. VirtualBox is really good from the point of view that it is available in most Linux distributions repositories. It is free, and it is from Oracle. It was originally from Sun Microsystems before Oracle took them over. But Oracle has continued to offer it, for free, and that's a good thing. And it's still quite functional. But if you're using VMware at work and you want some compatibility there, VMware is typically not available in Linux repositories, primarily because it is developed as a commercial product. So you do need to go to VMware's website to get it. I'm not sure which file you're downloading that gives you a text file, unless it's the installation instructions. But depending on which version of Linux you're using, you're looking for something that ends in .deb or something that ends in .rpm. And if they don't offer either of those are the two file formats for a Debian-based distribution and a Red Hat-based distribution. And if they don't offer that, they'll offer something that ends in .tar.gz or something that is a compressed file, and they'll give you some text-based instructions on how to install it from that file. You don't want to just double-click that file and expect it to install. It's typically not going to do that. They may provide a script inside of the package. I haven't used VMware myself, so I can't speak from experience, but Charles, perhaps you have.
Charles?
If you're still there.
You guys are breaking up on me. Say that one more time.
Okay. So we're talking about installing VMware's player on Linux. Uh-huh. And the fact that it's not going to be in the distributions, you need to go to their website. And what I was saying is that I have not used VMware, so I don't have any personal experience in installing it. Do they provide a deb package or an RPM package for you?
It's not. It's provided for all distros as a bundle.
Okay.
But you run the sh.forward/name.bundle, and it's got a built-in script for itself.
Right.
And it works really well. I mean, there are still a couple of little glitches. I think they fixed it in the last update. I've got VMware Workstation because I'm a very heavy virtualizer, and VirtualBox doesn't have support for USB 3.
Right.
So it works beautifully. There's some little glitches with entering in a serial number, but once you get past that, it runs like a champ.
Okay, great. So for Mike, the person who's emailing us, you should be able to do this. The text file you're getting is probably the instructions, or maybe it's the script itself that you're opening, and it's opening up in a text editor or something like that. So take a look on the VMware website. They should have some installation instructions or something that guides you through, and it sounds like there's a script that just runs and installs it for you, and you should be up and running. So hopefully that helps.
If he's got an objection to using VirtualBox, that one has a deb. It's still well supported. It's relatively good. And I mean, if you go with from what I remember, he's using it in an enterprise environment, right?
Yes, exactly. And his company uses VMware, which is why I think he wants to stick with that rather than VirtualBox.
Okay. Well, I mean, with your company using it, you should be able to use their VMX server, is what I think it's called. Which is basically just their VMware hosted server. All it does is run virtual machines. And then Linux, you can use VNC or the RDP desktop client and get the exact same effect. So you're not using local resources to connect to virtuals.
Right, right. And of course, that supposes that, unlike my company, they don't have it behind a protected firewall, and they provide no login access for anything other than Windows computers. But that's another story.
And you know, it's very entertaining to me when I hear about companies who are Linux and they're trying to do this. You never hear about the companies who are running either all Mac or all Windows getting hacked. I wonder why.
I don't know.
All right. Well, John has another question about virtual machines. Continue on in this vein.
Right. Yes, I purposely juxtaposed the two emails. So, John's question. Hi, guys. I love your advanced episode on virtual machines. I listened to it 3 times. I use Clonezilla to make an 85-gigabyte image file of my current Linux Ubuntu desktop OS. My question is, after I move it to my new computer and start it up in VirtualBox, can I trash the huge image file? For example, is VirtualBox importing it, or is it running the OS from it? Thanks for the great show. By the way, can you do a show on VPNs? I want to make a tunnel between me in Georgia, USA, and my cousin in Florida, USA, but I am confused about if I need a host machine for the two clients and all the certificate stuff.
Okay.
Okay. So VPNs, we may tackle that in a future episode, so we'll keep that in our pipeline of things to think about.
Larry, actually, quick one. Another Linux variant for you. If he said his cousin and one of their people are using have their at-home routers and their Linksys devices or Netgears, check out a Linux distribution called DDWRT. It is a very, very light Linux distro that allows point-to-point VPNs. So using that on your firewall or your router turns your $50 router into a $500 router. And now you can connect all of you together without having to exchange certificates or do any of that other high-speed stuff. You just have to follow the process on getting it installed, and you're good to go.
Wow.
Absolutely. And, Craig, what we're talking about here is installing a Linux operating system on your router.
Right.
Yep.
Pretty cool.
Don't most routers use Linux as their OS? I mean,
many of them do, and many of them use an embedded version that is configured specifically for that to give you the features that the hardware vendor wants you to have. Yeah. But what DDWRT does is it's an open source version specifically made for the Linksys routers. And it runs particularly well on certain models of Linksys routers as well. But it's specifically designed to do this, to replace the standard operating system, the embedded Linux that's on there, with this version that gives you much more control, allows you the ability to control just about everything on that router and use it in ways that a normal $50 router can't be used. As Charles just said, it gives you the capabilities of $500 commercial full enterprise-grade router on your cheap little Linksys.
Really cool stuff.
You betcha. So getting back to John's email about virtual machines, so I'm reading in a little bit to what he's saying here. So he had a Linux operating system on a desktop, and he used Clonezilla to make a backup image of it. And if he made a full cloned image as opposed to just making a backup of the data, then what he has is he can use Clonezilla to put that image of his desktop in the VirtualBox environment. So essentially cloning his desktop within VirtualBox, exactly as it was on the hardware he started with. That you can do. And if that's what he's doing here, and I'm thinking that's what he's doing, then once he has that image inside a VirtualBox, yes, you can delete your backup image. I'd keep it around just as a backup in case you need it. But, of course, you can make a backup copy of the VirtualBox image if you need that. But bottom line is, yeah, you can trash that huge image, that 85 gigabyte image, and you don't need to worry about that anymore, and just continue to use it in VirtualBox, and away you go.
Okay, all right. So let's continue on with Richard.
One other point, sorry to interrupt, Craig, but one other point I wanted to make there is the fact that you can do this with Linux is kind of interesting. You can take a Linux installation off of your hardware, off of your computer, and you can make a copy of that, a clone of that, and you can put it in a virtual environment. That's something that if you tried that with Windows 7 or even Windows XP, you're going to confuse the heck out of Windows, because it will wake up in that virtual environment and say, ooh, wait a minute, all of the hardware is different from the last time I was awake. The hard drive is different. The video drive is different. The wireless card is different. The hardware network card is different. Oh, my goodness. You're going to have to get another license of Windows. This is invalid. And it won't work. But with Linux, you can take an image of Linux that you had running on a laptop and move it over to a desktop. Just on the hardware, just blast that image over onto that hardware, and it will figure out what it needs in the way of drivers, and it will just work. And same thing when moving it from hardware to virtual machine or virtual machine to hardware. You can do that with Linux, and it's absolutely impossible with Windows.
All right. Good enough.
Okay.
Move on to Richard, okay? And
all right. So Richard is describing his experience moving to Ubuntu's Unity desktop. And what he's describing is not an uncommon experience for users experiencing Unity, the desktop environment in today's Ubuntu, for the first time. Richard writes, "Hi, guys. I just installed Ubuntu on my HP Netbook 2133 computer. Aside from the usual Broadcom Wi-Fi chipset not working, everything installed okay. As an aside, I have to say, Broadcom has gotten a lot better in its Wi-Fi being supported under Linux, but in older computers, and especially in netbooks, they're just crap. But anyway, moving on."
I never understood that. I mean, the BMWC, like, community compiled driver.
Mm-hmm.
Or the using what was the tool? There was a tool that you had to use to actually get Windows that it would decompile and then recompile the Windows driver, or actually
right.
use a service bus to pass communications using the Windows driver.
Yep.
Always a nightmare.
Yeah. And I don't know. At one point in time, Broadcom was, I swear, purposely making it so that, you know, the Linux drivers wouldn't work with their latest chipsets, but that somewhat has gone away as Broadcom has progressed.
It's like a rivalry or something.
Yeah, maybe that's what was going on. Anyway, continuing with Richard's email, he said, "My first step was to get the desktop color just the way I like it, TARDIS blue." Yes,
wow.
The Doctor fan. That worked fine. Next, I wanted to get that ridiculous taskbar from the top of the screen to the bottom, where it should be. No can do, not possible with this version of Linux. That was strike one. I found myself always wanting to close windows by clicking on the little X in the upper right-hand corner of the window. They moved it over to the left side. Why? That was strike two. The icons on the left side of the screen are very annoying. I didn't even try to get rid of them. That was strike three. You're out. I took Ubuntu off my computer. The Unity interface tries to change the way we use computers. This is like someone putting a Dvorak keyboard on your computer. You'd have to learn how to type all over again. What if you got into your car and realized that they put the gas pedal on the left and the brake pedal on the right? You would have to learn how to drive all over again. Or what if they changed the meaning of the traffic signals? Now green means stop and red means go. Talk about dyslexic. When you go into a dark room and reach for the light switch, you're able to turn the light on because they standardized the location of the switch. Now, if you're on Mars and people there are 3 feet tall, maybe the light switch should be lower, but not on Earth. I think Mark Shuttleworth is trying to leave his, quote, mark on the world. Leave the interface alone. We like things the way they are. Unity may be good for Martians, but not for us, Richard." A lot of people like Unity.
Yeah, I am one of the people who actually enjoy the Unity interface. I mean, it is a bit of a shocker to you at first when you first load it up. You're like, what is this?
Right.
You know, but It's got a very modern, very intuitive feeling to it. And, you know, for people like me who like minimalist, it's perfect. You know,
exactly.
There's not a whole lot going on. There's not a bunch of stuff on my desktop. It's all neatly organized on the left-hand side. I love it.
Yeah, and a lot of people do like that. And a lot of people say, hey, it looks just like the Mac. And if you put the dock over on the left, it kind of does. But anyway, so Richard is one of those people who doesn't like it, and Charles is one of those people who do, and there's something for each. And if you don't like it, you don't have to use it. You can continue to use Unity and change the desktop environment, or just use a different distribution.
And variety is what makes the world go round, you know?
There you go.
What if that Martian has tentacles, you know, then...
Then all bets are off. Maybe the light switch won't even work.
Okay.
All right, so our next email is from Paul,
yes,
who has a problem writing from USB or SD media card in his Linux Mint 13 and a Sansa MP3 player malfunction. For a short email, he packs a lot in there. Anyway, he says, "Hello, Larry. All of a sudden, my Sansa Fuse MP3 player stopped working.
Oh.
It's not even recognized by any computer."
It's known as.
Yes, either that or it's dead. Is there any Linux application that will allow me to remove the files that are on the Sansa? Any app that will let me get access to the Sansa? Second part of my problem, I now have to open the USB flash drive or media card as root in order to delete or move files from the flash drive or media card. I started noticing this after I executed some commands in the terminal in an effort to solve the above problem with the Sansa. Dun, dun, dun. Thanks, Paul.
That was totally exact. That was going to be my question. Like, okay, normally when you get read errors and permission errors on something, it means you were playing in the terminal and you entered in one, either a change ownership or a change mod or what's the other one? Change owner, chown. What's the other one? There's a –
yeah.
You started messing with the permission ones. You know, yeah. For that user, I bet you $10. If he were to go back through and he were to change, and what did he say he was on, Larry? He was on Ubuntu.
Yeah.
He's on Linux Mint 13.
Ubuntu.
Yeah.
if he were to go into his mount directory and put in his disk and do a change owner or a change mod, as a change mod, one of those.
Yeah,
I think
it's
a change owner.
It's change
you know. Mod. To back to his user. Now he's going to have to get his Google on to figure out how to do that, and do it recursive for that directory and set it as persistent. Every time he plugs it in, he won't have to worry about it.
Right, exactly. And I'm thinking, though, that since none of his computers are recognizing the Sansa Fuse, he needs a new MP3 player. And of course, I think he's just trying to get his files off of the card that's in the Sansa. And generally speaking, if you have access to a card reader and you just put the card reader in there, it should just open up in the file manager and you should be able to drag and drop the files. But it sounds like maybe in the process of dying, his Sansa corrupted some of the files or the file system itself. And maybe there's more to it than that, but it sounds like in trying to follow some suggestions that other folks may have made on the forums that he was visiting and typing in some commands blindly, he's made the situation worse. And that is a lesson to be learned that I learned the hard way when I first started using Linux. Don't just take the commands that people suggest to you on a forum post and just type them in blindly. Think about what they say. Ask about what this does before you go typing it in. And worst case, you find what the command is, like that chown or that change mod, and you either type in after the command dash dash help, or you go in and you type man for manual and then the command. And it will give you a description of what this thing does. And be very careful. Make sure you understand what you're doing before you do it.
Really good tip. Read the whole forum.
Ah, yeah.
Keep reading when you find like. And you know what? I've done this myself, so I am guilty of this. I see it and I'm like, I found the answer. I enter it in and it just messes up everything. You know. Luckily, I'm one of those people who duplicate his issues in a virtual environment, destroy the virtual environment before I play with it in my production. You know. But you know, you read the whole forum because. Typically, when that happens, you have someone else who's in your not so unique position and will say, "Actually, this broke mine."
Yeah, exactly. If you're reading post 5 of 457 posts, you might want to go on to the end and see what actually solved the problem.
Exactly.
Because those interims don't.
We are at the bottom of the hour break, and we're going to continue on. Charles Tendell is my co-host. Larry Bushy is our guest, our correspondent. We're talking about all Linux things. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about our contest, too. We'll be right back. This is Computer America.
Hello.
Hello, this is your London Minute, brought to you by Squarespace. Everything you need to build an exceptional website. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code LONDONMINUTE to get 10% off your purchase. Some things get lost in translation. Take the Finnish company Nokia, that's been in the news recently due to Microsoft's proposed plan to buy the phone portion of the business. It's Nokia to some, but you may say Nokia or Nokia. The British will say Nokia, which is a fine whisper away from what's said in Finland. If you say Nokia, then you are a country mile from the Finnish head office pronunciation. Oddly, the American CEO of Nokia, Stephen Elop, gets it wrong, while Steve Ballmer, outgoing Microsoft CEO, gets it right. So let's have a practice. Try saying Nokia.
Nokia.
Or, to simplify matters, we could just decide to pronounce Nokia with a silent N.
Nokia.
Like this. Microsoft.
Exactly. I knew that was coming. I knew it.
Shireichel for Computer America.
I love that woman. That is awesome. I knew it. If she hadn't said it in that London Minute, I was going to say it.
That was cool.
Thanks for that. That's a brand new London Minute, and we bring a brand new one every Saturday here at Computer America on the Blog Talk Radio network. Okay, so we're continuing on. It's our all last all Linux show. It's the last half hour of the program, and Larry Bushy, our guest correspondent, the creator of the Going Linux podcast, is here with us. And we're now going to go to an email. By the way, you can read all these, again, at computeramerica.com. Just go to our show notes page. You'll see the links there, and you'll see everything that we're talking about on today's show and then some.
Don't get stuck on the picture of the handsome co-host. You got to scroll. You know, it's right up at the top and under archives.
Oh, boy. Got Alfred, who has a question about Ubuntu and printing on long bond paper.
Right.
All right.
Okay, and Alfred says, hello, sir. nobody calls me sir. I got your email ad. I got your email address from the Frugal Computer Guy on YouTube because I'm having this problem with printing on Ubuntu. When I try to print on a long bond paper, it is not printing the lower part around 2 centimeters from the margin, even if it's inside the print area. The paper I'm using is the same size on paper/paper settings, so everything I will print every time I will print a long bond, I print it to Windows 8, and that works just fine. What do you think must be the problem? So, I provided an email response to Alfred, and I suggested that he take a look if he's referencing the Frugal Computer Guy. Michael over there does some excellent tutorials on LibreOffice. So I took a stab in the dark and I thought, well, maybe it's a LibreOffice setting. And I asked him to check that in LibreOffice. He goes into the format menu and selects page and make sure that long bond is selected, and then go to the menus for the printer settings and make sure that in the printer dialog box to click on properties and make sure that paper size is set to legal or whatever is the size that's appropriate for him. And so after, about a week, he got back to me and said in a follow-up email, he said, hi, Larry, thanks for your response. I'm still getting the error on my printing. I already followed the instructions you have said, but the same thing happened. The bottom area is about 2 inches from the margin. He said 2 centimeters last time. There's a difference there.
Right.
Or I guess it's called border. It's not getting printed unlike in Windows 8. Are there still other ways and other suggestions you have? Well, about the only suggestion I would have at this point is maybe the driver that Linux chose for you is not the most recent driver or not the correct driver. It's possible that it made the wrong choice. Or if you chose the driver when installing the printer, which is more likely the case, then perhaps you chose the wrong one. Typically, what you do to install a print driver is you plug in the printer and it just installs the right one.
Actually, I've had something similar happen recently, without knowing the kind of printer that he's using. If he's using, say, maybe an HP printer, the Linux drivers for HP are several versions behind, and they don't work altogether too well. You can actually download an up-to-date, brand new, like current, you know, maintained by HP printer from their website under their printer driver section. It's going to require – it's a little command line foo, but it's very straightforward and right there to the point. And, you know, me and my wife both had a problem where sometimes it wouldn't print, the scanner wouldn't work right, some other issues would happen, and it's the HPLIF print drivers.
Mm-hmm.
Once we updated to that, once we switched over and actually installed the dedicated ones, we got a high-speed little HP logo top right-hand corner of our status bar, and we've not had a glitch since. She prints a lot of legal stuff, and we were having that same problem where like the footer just would not print.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because printer drivers are critical. I mean, down to the make and not only that, but the model specific printer. And if you have the wrong driver, you will get some, you know, flaky things happening. It really needs to be a driver specifically designed for that make and model printer. So, and it sounds to me like what the problem that Alfred is having is definitely driver related. And I'm you know, I say this to all of our listeners, and you probably should say this to all of your listeners, Larry, is that the more information they volunteer to you, the better you can answer them. So it's interesting that Alfred wrote you two times, and he still didn't include the make and model print.
These are only two of the emails that he provided, and none of them had the printer model. So, yeah, point well taken.
Yeah, tell us what printer you have, the make and model, and then probably we can probably help you more. And that's to everybody who writes to you, Computer America or Larry. You know, the more info, give us a description of what equipment you're using. If it's an equipment-related problem, if it's software, give us the version number. You know, so we can do. Otherwise, it's like going to a doctor and blindfolding your doctor and say, try to diagnose me. You know, you have to tell us what you have so we can help.
Alfred, and anyone else who wants computer and technology support, and you live abroad, I would be happy to fly out to you if you buy me a first class round trip ticket.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I'll spend an entire day with you, 2 days in your country, having a good time.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, sure. And I'll even broadcast the show from your location, so you feel, you know.
There it is. Alfred, we'll try it out. But in the meantime, check out the driver because it sounds like it's a driver related problem, and if it's an HP, go to the printer manufacturer's website and go to their support and then download section and find your printer and download the driver there rather than what the operating system is trying to upgrade for. And you'll be assured of having the latest driver. And I have a feeling that your problem is going to go away when you do that.
Yeah. And make sure you get the Linux version, of course, of the driver. And if they offer various versions for different distributions. I think he said that his distribution he's using is Ubuntu. Typically, they're going to describe it as an Ubuntu driver or a Debian driver or something like that. And that driver will work for any Debian derivative distribution. And make sure you don't get the RPM version. That's for the Red Hat and the Fedora folks. And if they don't offer either of those, like Mike, our first emailer, was trying to install VMware, you may need to run a script, and it will do the installation for you. But one way or another, that should help you out.
Yeah, yeah. And again,
Larry, this is a burning question before we get to our next email.
All right, okay, continue on.
Larry, what is your distro of choice?
Linux Mint.
Oh, wow.
Well, before let me just punctuate again this. I mean, to Alfred and everybody else. I mean, if you go to a doctor and you say I'm sick, you know, you have to give them information. You need, and I'm amazed that Alfred wrote you so many times and didn't bother to tell you the make and model of his printer. You know,
we're not picking on you, Alfred.
Oh, but
we really aren't.
But you got to let us know. If we're going to help you, you got to let us know what exactly it is that you have, and then we can help you further. But anyway, that's a shot in the dark. We think it's your drivers, and go along, and then let us know.
Give it a try. Yeah, let us know. Email us back and let us know. Yeah. So Charles, why did you want to know what distribution I use?
Why were you
surprised when it was Mint?
I'm not really, because Mint has – I was a developer on Linux Mint when it first came out.
Aha.
And we were, you know – the lead developer, Clem, and I had a bit of a falling out when he made a political statement that I did not agree with, and
the famous blog post?
Yes.
Got it. Okay, yeah. I understand.
And it wasn't that I stopped using Linux Mint. Like, I was still a very faithful Linux Mint user, and I still did some debugging and still did some other things with it. But some of his maneuvers demonstrated his political position, and I was like, "Your Linux distro should not matter. It should not care what your political views are." So I kind of fell off the project a little bit. But, you know, I'm a Ubuntu proper, but that's only been for the last year or so. Mm-hmm. I was a dedicated, like, Linux Mint went on everything.
Yeah.
I've got an old computer, Mint, you know, because it was the perfect setup for everything. But
or
then
I got a new computer, Mint.
Yep. New computer, Mint. You know, I'm going to Mint it. You know, but
yeah.
it became that all of the things, you know, and I'm a fan of simplicity.
Yeah.
When I tried Ubuntu when 12, I think it was, with Unity on it, and I put it on a machine that should have had absolutely no reason to slow down. i7, you know, 2.4 gigahertz with 16 gigs of RAM and a solid state drive, and it ran like dirt. Mm-hmm. And I was like, "What in the world?" And I heard, and I did some researching and some looking around, and it was because of Unity, and Unity was sucking down my resources. So I switched over to Linux Mint, switched back to my alma mater, loved it, and it ran like a champ. But then I started, you know, there were some tweaks and some fixes and some things that I liked having in my distro that weren't there, and I started adding them, and they started breaking, and then 13 came out. And I was like, you know, let me give you Ubuntu one more shot, because, you know, all of the commands that I'm doing, everything that I'm doing for Mint is actually Ubuntu. It's I'm getting all my information from the Ubuntu knowledge bases and everything else. So I switched to 13 when it came out, and they fixed all of the memory leakage issues with Unity. Oh, such a difference. And I haven't been back.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of things that I could suggest you take a look at if you haven't already. Mm-hmm. Kendall Weaver left the Linux Mint project to start Peppermint OS.
Nice.
And Peppermint started, and it was, you know, as a new offshoot of Linux Mint, he uses some of the Mint tools. He uses the Mint updater and several other of the Mint tools. So there's a lot of good stuff still in there. It is primarily designed as a cloud-based operating system. In other words, it comes pre-installed with almost nothing. But it has, you know, how Chrome has the ability to create an icon that launches a website as though it were an application. Mm-hmm. They use that exclusively, and so the email client on Peppermint is Gmail, and they rely heavily on Google for the stuff that they pre-install, but it's a full Linux distribution, so you can install whatever you want. If you like Thunderbird, if you like Empathy, whatever, you can install all of that. That's number one. I have that on a home server that I have that I log into using Guacamole. But so
it
I have...
Sounds like the Chrome OS. Chrome OS.
It's exactly analogous to that, except that because it's an Ubuntu-derived Linux Mint-inspired Linux distribution, you're not locked in as you are in Chrome. You can, it's a full Linux distribution. So that's something you might want to take a look at. And another one that I'm thinking of switching to is Solus OS, S-O-L-U-S OS. And Solus OS is really slick. It runs smoothly. It runs fast. It's got some things that are a little non-standard, if you can call anything in Linux standard. Some of the applications they've chosen are a little off the beaten path, but it works extremely well. And if I can get over the hurdle of, I'd have to change my this or I'd have to change that. I'm getting stuck in my ways in my old age. Yeah. But it is really, really an interesting distribution to take a look at, and I would recommend that you give it a try. My co-host, Bill, used it for almost a month, which is unheard of for him. He's a distro hopper, and he really loved it, and he only went back to Ubuntu Studio because he had to get some work done. So, so anyway, those two I would recommend. And you try. I've been using Peppermint for a while, and I tried its very first version, and they're on Peppermint 4 now, and they've done a fantastic job. And I'm looking at Solus OS seriously as well. But until I find something better, political affiliations and political opinions aside, on the part of the folks at Linux Mint, I have maintained that it is the best distribution out there, especially for new Linux users, and yep. I'll stick by that until I find something better.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Linux Mint, this Linux Mint is the distro that I install on, you know, my parents or anyone who's got an old Windows XP box that are just like, I don't want to get a new computer. I don't use this one that much, but I want it to be functional. It's slow and it's killing me. I'll slap Linux Mint on there, and I think they're on what their – I can't remember what the name of their latest one is.
I don't go by the name. I just go by the version.
The number.
Of
yeah.
15, yeah.
Yeah. The funny thing was originally it wasn't – it was – I think the story was – or it was a rumor. Clem actually named the first three after his girlfriends. Like, you know, his girlfriend, wife. Like, whoa.
Okay. I can imagine.
Hey, gentlemen, I just got a tweet from Patricia Reichel. I mean, she's listening to the show, and she says,
cool.
Here's hoping your hard drive never becomes squiffy.
Squiffy!
Love it. Love it.
You got to use that outro now.
Good night. You know, exactly. There you go. All right.
Amazing. Okay.
We may do that on tonight's show. All right. Let's continue on here with we have, you know, Jay and Silent Bob. We have Jay who wrote us with help for an issue that KY Engineer, who is a chat room regular, by the way. I think he has a MacBook Air. He emailed us about back in April. And let's read KY Engineer's email.
Yeah, so KY Engineer originally emailed us saying, hello, guys, I've been listening to your show for a while, and I have become a Linux fan. I want to host a web server from my home. This is a hobby project. I'm running an Apache web server on Ubuntu Server operating system in VirtualBox on my PC. I want to make my website available on the internet. The computer sits on my home network and is connected to the internet by AT&T UVerse. I have found the broadband IPv4 address. It's 107.210.xxx.xxx. I guess he didn't really want us having his IP address. Anyway, the problem is
that he
I can't
to host his website off.
Yes, exactly. Okay. The problem is I can't see the website from the internet. I have set up port forwarding in my router. I think the problem is the VirtualBox setup. Can you or someone in the chat room point me in the right direction? I believe one of the chat room regulars knows about virtual machines. Thanks, KY Engineer. And we went back and forth, and I think KY got his problem solved. But Jay has provided an email with a suggestion. And this was back in April that KY Engineer asked the question, and it was the Going Linux episode 204. So Jay's email says, I just listened to show 204 tonight, and I thought I would weigh in on a topic you raised. KY in the chat mentioned problems with his virtual machine web server being seen from the internet.
I can't help it.
He capitalizes it.
I mean, is it Kentucky Engineer or KY as in Kentucky. Lube Engineer?
It's Kentucky.
Kentucky. Too long to type. He's a KY Engineer. Yes, exactly.
Anyhow, I will substitute that for the two letters then. So yeah. Kentucky in the chat mentioned problems with his virtual machine web server being seen from the internet. You mentioned several articles by Nightwise on the subject, which are great references, but the solution is actually very simple. Virtual machine software programs such as VirtualBox set up their virtual machines to run under NAT networking by default. This means any virtual machines are hidden behind a virtual router on the host PC. Nothing else on your LAN will be able to access these machines by default. What Kentucky should do is go to the virtual machine settings and change this. On VirtualBox, this is under the Devices menu, Network tab. Simply change the NAT setting to Bridged Adapter, and your virtual machine will now be visible on the host network.
Wow.
Port forwarding. Yes, and I'll let you describe that in a minute. Port forwarding from his UVerse router should now see it. Keep in mind, you're now live on the web, so keep those firewall settings up on your virtual machine, Jay.
Sometimes it's just something really simple like that, but until you know about it, you know, it might as well be, you know.
There's one other step to that one, so yep. Hopefully they listen to this one. When you change from the NAT to the bridged, you're going to be reassigned a new IP address from your host network. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to change your port forwarding to the new IP address of your virtual machine.
Right.
You know, if you don't – I mean, there's also another way to do it where where you don't have to do port forwarding, you don't have to do any of that type. Well, you still have to do port forwarding, but using a dynamic DNS application, you can go to dynedns.org and you can sign up for either their free package or their paid package. And regardless of what IP address that machine ends up gleaning, like if you change it or you move it or do anything else, it automatically updates DynDNS to point to your new IP address. This is if you don't have a static IP address with your provider.
Right.
If you do, then you don't really need to worry about it.
Good points.
Okay, there it is. So maybe you should put that in the email to him, or you know, your response to him, the alternatives.
Sure.
Yeah. Exactly.
Sounds great.
Okay. All right. Well, we have time maybe for one more.
Okay.
Ben. Now, this is not our Ben. This is a different Ben.
Different Ben.
Ben asks about desktop environments.
So Ben writes, hello, all. Thanks for I'm not aware that we have anybody named all in our podcast. But anyway, thanks for everything you guys do on the Going Linux podcast. I recently have loaded Mint with KDE Desktop and was curious of the different editions, Mate, XFCE, KDE, Cinnamon, and what preference you have. I've heard Cinnamon thrown around on your podcast a bit. However, I was curious if there is a way to change a different edition without reloading from the image. Thanks, Ben. Well, I think what he's saying there is, can I change my desktop environment without having to reinstall the Linux Mint that I'm using? And the answer is absolutely 100%. Yes. The best way to do this would be to go into the software manager in Linux Mint, which gives you access to all the repositories. And I think he said he was on KDE. If you want to go to Cinnamon, you search for Cinnamon Desktop in the repositories, and there will be a selection that you will choose from there, probably a bunch of different packages. Look for the one that talks about Cinnamon Desktop or Cinnamon Desktop Package, and typically that package will be the one that brings in all of the dependencies you want. And that will then install the Cinnamon Desktop next to your KDE. And the next time you log out and log back in, or you reboot your computer, you don't have to reboot, just log out and log back in. When you get to the login screen where you put in your username and password, you get a choice of which desktop environment to use, and you can switch between the two.
All right. Well, gentlemen, we are out of time. Larry, again, thank you so much for being here with us on today's show. And
pleasure, as always.
Glad you were able to meet Charles Tendell. And again, you can go to the Computer America website, and you can see under the Friends of the Show, you can see the link to the Going Linux podcast.
Larry, before we run out of time, what is your Twitter name?
It is Going Linux.
All right.
Oh, I should have guessed.
On Monday, we're going to have a company called FreePrints on the show that allows you to make free prints from your mobile device. That's right. And then in hour two, we're going to have computer and technology news, and that's brought to you by Slimware Utilities. They're the official optimization software of Computer America. So have a great weekend, and we'll see you on Monday night. So, in
depth,
Fisher Reichel, until Monday night, this is Craig Crossman hoping that your hard disk never becomes squiffy.
Yes,
he says squiffy. We'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye. Say goodnight, Charles.
Good night, Charles.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.